everybody. I'm Debbie Harris, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
It's really a treat to be here, and or maybe to be back. I'm not really sure which I should say. I was delighted to be asked to share here tonight, and I was all ready to do it last week, and so I've been kind of afraid to look at Clancy this week. I'm waiting for him to flag me down, and but so far he hasn't done that. So I'm really delighted to be here tonight. And I'm delighted and honored to be asked to share at any meeting of alcoholics. Oh, God, now they're waving at me in the back. Oh, God. Let's see. I better have a drink with that one. A couple of things, you know, sometimes I know it amazes me that this is all we talk about up here, but the only deal or my only thing to share with you tonight is my alcoholism, my experience, strength, and hope. I'm not here to share with you how to tear a transmission apart or how to do the job I do. I'm just here to share with you my life and my experiences. My only qualification is that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety is date is February the 8th, 1976. And if you're counting, that means I celebrated 12 years in February. Now, that isn't my first sobriety date, but it is my last sobriety date so far. And the another thing I want to share with you is that my home group, I'm a member in good standing at the Bellflower Big Book Group. And, you know, I wondered if you were going to do that again this time. I was ready for it this time. And, well, we patterned our meeting after you, so, you know, I'm glad to be a part of that. And I'm a member in good standing because I'm there every week. And if I'm not, I'm at another AA commitment, which I try to minimize on Monday nights especially. And it's important for me to be a member of a home group. Not just for me, but the people who come along, because as much as I want to welcome the newcomers here tonight, I want to especially thank the people who have been sober longer than I've been around here, because you were the ones who were here and stayed sober and kept the meetings going so that when I did come around, they'd be here for me. And so I want to welcome and thank you for being here. I was reminded not too long ago, a few years ago, the importance of my presence at a home group and why it's so important to be a regular. And I at one point lived in Atlanta, and I was at a meeting that night, and I didn't want to go that night. You know how you get sometimes, you just don't want to go, and you're saying that as you're driving your car to the meeting. And I showed up at the meeting, and I'm there, and this gal came in, and she'd been on a drunk for about a year. She'd been there a year before, and she'd went out, and she came back, and she said, "You're still here." And to me, those few words meant an awful lot. It told me that, yes, I have a real responsibility to be here for the new people when they come back, to show them that Alcoholics Anonymous does work, and that I am an example of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that we're not just going to fold up, we're not a fly-by-night deal, and that we will be here, and that I have the responsibility to be there when they come back. I'm 30. Now, this is probably the last year I'll tell anybody how old I am, but the only reason I even tell it to you now is because I was never going to see 30. I remember very clearly when I was 17 years old, I was in my little car and tipping up a bottle of whiskey, which was a very natural thing for me to do. And I remember one night so clearly thinking, I'll never see 30, but I don't care. Doesn't make any difference to me. I'm going out with a party, you know. I'm going out with fun. And I never thought I'd see 30, and I didn't care about that. And today I just really feel that by, you know, turning 30 was just such a gift that my time really is. I need to make it count. I've learned how to live one day at a time and make each day count over these last few years more than I really ever had before. So that's kind of a couple things that I like to share with you before I forget. And I also, one other thing that's very important to me is that I have a sponsor, an active sponsor in my life, not just somebody by name, but somebody I actively use in my life. She's a member of this group, and it was a real kick last week when there was five generations of us here, and it was such a comforting and warm feeling. I didn't have my first real live official sponsor till I was 2 years sober. I guess before that, I basically used the old-timers that I hung around with, and I was very active in the Alcoholics Anonymous with, and I, but not a real live official sponsor till I was 3, and I don't recommend that to anybody, because at 12, I can't even imagine going without a sponsor. I know how funny I kind of felt even making the transition, moving from Atlanta out here and not having that local contact. And it's just such a comforting feeling, because I was the kind of person who, in the beginning, you know, they'd tell you, get a sponsor. And so I would just kind of ask somebody, and then I'd never call them, or I'd go to a different meeting or never see them. I never did anything about sponsorship. And I can't imagine being without one today. And so it's a very important part of my life. I had my first drink when I was 12 years old in 1970 on a Friday night in April. And I remember that so clearly. 1970 in my life would set a lot of courses for me that I, of course, would not know. At the beginning of the year, my parents separated and would later divorce. And to me, that was really kind of wonderful, because now I had two people vying for my attention and bringing me presents. And when you're an only child, that is selfishness and self-obsession and self-involvement are just natural. And I just was filled up with all this kind of stuff. So for me, again, on that selfish basis, I loved it, the fact that this was happening in a way. And then in April, boy, my life would never be the same again. We were getting together for a party on a Friday night, and prior to this time, I really never understood why people got so excited about the weekends, because I had nothing to do. And I heard them talking about drinking, and somehow or another I figured out that, the most you could get was drunk. And I've never seen anybody drunk, or I never heard of anybody, well, we don't talk about Uncle So-and-so, or there weren't any black sheep that I found out about until I was sober about 4 years. I found a couple. But I've never seen any alcoholic drinking in the home. My parents are really those social drinkers where they can have a drink, they put the whiskey bottle back in the cupboard where it gathers more dust until the next group of guests come over. And I don't understand that, and they never understood the way I drank. But that particular week I was so excited, because this was like my debut. You know, it was very important that I didn't blow this deal on Friday night. I wanted to be a part of, I wanted to be accepted, and I wanted to basically be the things that I am today in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wanted to be okay around my peers, and that was why I drank that first night. But so Friday came along, and it would set the patterns the way I would drink for the next 5 years. And it was Friday, and it was 6 o'clock, and a bunch of us kids were all getting together in a girlfriend's basement. It was kind of, you know, like a liquid potluck. You know, everybody brought a little something to drink. And that night, you can about imagine, it was whatever their parents had in their cupboards, you know, that everybody brought. And I know that I loved it. I just never had had that feeling before where I couldn't get enough. And I loved the taste of it. I loved what it did for me. I just saw the world in a whole different new way. And I that night would set a lot of the drinking patterns for me, because we started at 6 o'clock. I drank everything I was allowed to, everything they would give me, as much as they would let me. And I blacked out for the first time. I passed out for my first time. I came to 3 hours later at about 9 o'clock with the dry heaves, and I wanted to go back to the party because I knew I'd gotten drunk, and that meant I'd had a good time, because that would always be the equation. I hadn't any foggiest idea what I did, but I knew I'd gotten drunk, and that meant I'd had a good time. So
that was a Friday night, and the next morning, a friend of mine talks about how it seemed like his life seemed to be going okay, and then he had that first drink, and where a lot of people were restless, irritable, and discontent, and then they were satisfied after that first drink. And for me, it was like my friend. It seemed that life was okay. And after that first drink on Saturday morning, that's when I was restless, irritable, and discontent, because my whole life and thinking and emotions and everything had changed overnight. I knew where there was an answer. I knew where there was a place where there weren't any footballs in my gut. And that was in a bottle. That was from drinking, and it just did something for me. So that very next night, we gathered up a bunch of beer, and we got caught with it, and I knew from the very first that I would have to just be a little bit sneakier. I'd have to start lying, because this was too valuable to lose. So I started drinking on the weekends, and of course it progressed, and then we moved to a little town in North Dakota, and it really got to where, for the last year and a half, for me, it was every day. I had been introduced to the wonderful world of drugs after about a year of drinking, and the advantage that they had for me was it allowed me to delay the inevitable blackout. I'd kind of had a little system worked out, you know, where I knew if I drank so much of whiskey that I'd need so much of these, and most of the time the little system worked. Sometimes I'd forget, but, you know, I tried to do that because I did love to drink. I loved to drink. My favorite deal in my kind of a perfect day was a bottle of whiskey and a hit or two of acid, and that was my idea of a good day. And that's where I saw truth. Yeah, that's where I saw the world as it really was. About five years and three weeks after that first Friday night in April of 1970, on a Friday night once again, I found myself in a police car, but for a very different reason this time. I was on my way to a hospital. I was being committed for alcoholism and drug addiction in this hospital in North Dakota. And I went there, and I'm trying to explain to these guys that they've made a mistake, you know, that I'm too young to be an alcoholic. I'm only 17. I'm not even of legal age yet. I mean, it should count for something. And it never did. I've never had a drink legally. And so I was in this hospital for 7 weeks, and one of the things they did, of course, they introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never heard alcoholic or any other way of life. I never thought about any other way of life than the one I lived. I liked that one. I liked the way I was living. I didn't mind paying any of the prices. They weren't prices. I never looked at them in terms like that. It was just part of the deal. That's just the way it was. And they would take us to outside meetings on Friday nights. And I'd sit in the back row, and I'm so glad there's a back row. I've yet to meet a newcomer who hasn't sat in the back row, and if you want to find one, that's where they usually are. And so I sat in the back row next to the window, and I'd listen to the rock and roll band playing down the street, thinking, gee, I'd rather be there. And some old fossil, you know, would be standing up here trying to tell me, you know, to identify. And I'd say, oh, God, I'm so glad you got to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't even look like an alcoholic, you know. And it was the guys with the cauliflower ears and nose halfway across their face. And I was glad they got here, you know. But I had nothing in common with them, and yet I knew I did. Because inside, I rationalized every time I even got close to identifying with something, I just rationalized it away. I heard things that were very foreign to me, like when they'd go on the wagon. Can you imagine what this wagon must look like with these drunks on there? And I'd never heard of something like that. I didn't know anything about that, or stopping drinking, or controlling drinking, or like in the third chapter where it talks about, you know, taking a trip, that whole paragraph. I never thought about stuff like that, you know? I just drank, and I just, as much as I could and as often as I could. I didn't really go into thinking about stuff or making up reasons. They would talk about things like when they would lose families. And when I said, well, that doesn't apply to me, because when I left my family, it was of mutual agreement that I leave, and I was satisfied to go. So to me, that was not a loss of family. Jobs. They talk about jobs. And like many of us, I too learned to quit before I was fired. But I forgot until a couple of years ago, I had a bad habit of calling and quitting in a blackout and then going in the next day. Oh, God. Those are kind of embarrassing. I just came to pick up my things. I never had anything there, but I just came to pick up my things. And jails. They talk about jails. My God, I mean, some of these people have really been, I mean, they've been around the world in jails and scenic travelers. And I said, hey, I've only been in a jail 3 times, and every time it has been a misunderstanding. And, you know, I just thought that doesn't count. You know, it's not for something serious. The other thing that was, I would sit back there and I'd say, I am not that bad. And I find that so many times how I would, and I know many of the people that I've heard do, minimize. Before we get here, it's like, I'm not that bad. If I was that bad, I'd probably go to AA too. Then after we're here and we've been here a little while, boy, my story got bad. You know, I was just out there ripping and tearing. And I tell you, if I had known I was going to tell anybody about it, I wish it was a little more spicier. You know, yeah, I'd like it a little bit more exciting. I mean, like lots of institutions and wrecks and liver out to here. And I mean, you know, it's like that's the way I was. And now look at me now. And what a miracle Alcoholics Anonymous is. Well, I didn't physically come in here like that, or was that kind of a trail. And a couple of years ago, I was having an examination, and the guy was looking in my eyes, and he says, yeah, there looks to be a little scar damage or tissue on the liver. And I'll tell you, I could have kissed him. I was so happy to get that news. It's like, now I really qualify. You know, I am here. I have arrived in that liver department, you know. And I just was tickled, but he never would have understood that, so I didn't say anything. I just would have just made my day. So when I got here, I rationalized everything that I could. I didn't want to be one of you, because if I said that, then my drinking, I couldn't drink anymore, and I wasn't done yet, and I knew I wasn't done yet, and I didn't know when I wouldn't be done. I knew I'd drink again. After 7 weeks of this hospital, they decided to send me to an all-women's halfway house in Minneapolis. I was there, and I was terrified. I was petrified of women, and I had never been in a city that big, and it was a scary deal for me. But I went, and I was too afraid not to go, and, you know, I just didn't know what to do. So I went down there and arrived there on a Friday night as well. I stayed there 7 months, and I went to one meeting a month. Now, the only reason I even went that often was because I had to get a piece of paper signed. I wasn't interested in this way of life. And I didn't want anybody to get too close, because I knew I'm not going to be around here very long. And it was, I mean, I'd show up in a meeting and they said, well, what are you doing here? I mean, that's how strange it was for me to show up in a meeting. So I came to California. I went to San Jose to visit my mother for 2.5 weeks over the Christmas holidays to show her how wonderful I'd become without alcohol and drugs in my life. And, of course, why would I think to call Alcoholics Anonymous? I'm sure it's only in Minneapolis. And I never bothered, and I wasn't interested in going to meetings out here and all that kind of stuff. If I'm not going there, why would I want to go here? And I immediately got with my old friends, and they were drinking and drugging. And the first week, God, I was miserable because I wanted to be right there with them. And the last week and a half, I joined them. And I did the same kinds of combinations and everything, it was a real problem because something was different. I mean, it was completely different. Nothing was like it used to be. And I had those voices going on. And I had one person who'd been in AA long enough to know and have heard a few things, and that other person still wanting to be out there ripping and tearing and being like the old thing. And I kept saying, but if only I was with my old playmates, and if only I was on my old playgrounds, and if only. And the other person who'd been in AA was saying to my, hey, there are no if-onlys in this deal. I mean, this is it. You're done. You're an alcoholic. And the battle would continue, and I'd be drunk, and I'd want to be sober right now. And I'd almost be there, and I'd want to be just drunk because I couldn't stand it, and I couldn't look in the mirror, and the paranoia was so great. And I was seeing the things that had been there all along that I could not admit to myself were me. I had heard enough to know that I was, something was an alcoholic. It was, you know, we talk about that Dr. Jekyll being the nice guy and Mr. Hyde the ugly guy. And I, sober, I was the Mr. Hyde. That's when all the stuff came out, the rage and the confusion and the anger. That's when that came out. When I was peaceful to live around, is in that Dr. Jekyll mood, and that was how I got there, on a bottle of whiskey and a hit or two of acid. That's where I got to be. And that's the kind of person I liked being around, and I wasn't looking at consequences. And yet, I saw the things that had always been there. I saw that quiet craving, that phenomenon of craving that had started back in April of 1970, yet it had always been there, and I finally admitted it for the first time. I saw that compulsion that had always been there from that first night. I saw that for the first time. All those things I saw. And I came back to Minneapolis, and I wasn't going to tell anybody, but I'd acquired this thing called a conscience, and I didn't have much choice. And a few days later, you know, I've never been a great liar, so, you know, why start now? And I told the people, and they, I had a feeling I've learned my lesson, and that's how I felt about it. And so I went from one meeting a month to one meeting a week. And for me, that was progress, you know. So I'm starting to feel a little bit better. And about 5 weeks after I've returned on a Friday night, I get a letter in the mail. And that letter had a lump in it, and that lump was one joint. Now, I've never really liked pot. It was always messy and stinky, and you had to have all this paraphernalia. And I was, my attitude was, just give me some pills and let's go. And so why I even bothered to consider what I should do with it, I don't know. But I did. And I thought about it for about an hour, and I decided, like any still non-committed alcoholic, I'll keep it. You know, just in case. Just in case I need to take the edge off someday. That was the 6th of February. On the 7th of February, you can about imagine what I thought about all night long. On the 7th of February, that day became the someday. And I woke up that morning, and I didn't know that by 6 o'clock that night, my life would be in a totally different direction. I woke up that morning, and I didn't know that by the end of the day, that would be the last day till this day, I would take anything that would affect me. No, I didn't know that. I woke up that morning with one thought on my mind. I have a little list of things to do, and at the end of that list is that one joint. Because my sobriety is based on everything. I don't have two sobriety dates. I just have one. And so I started my day, and I did that little list. And when I lit that match, the conflict began. It was a conflict like that I had not had before, and it was, my mind felt like it was going to explode with all the confusion going on inside. And I ended up in a parking lot in a shopping center, and that's where I had my bottom. And I was searching around trying to find my car that I'd lost, and I had a deep and meaningful conversation with God, and it was basically, I've had it. I've had it. I can't live this way anymore. And when they were talking about that, I'd heard people talking about my best thinking got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's exactly what had happened. I had been running my life. I was doing exactly what I wanted to do. And when I'd run out of things to do and the conflicts, and I could not overcome them anymore, there was only one place that I knew to go to get relief and to get answers, and that was Alcoholics Anonymous. I went back to the halfway house, and I that night also I felt something different, and you'll know what I'm talking about, even though words can't describe the feeling. At that afternoon, I thought, you know, the first time that I didn't drink, I wouldn't even give it the name of sobriety. The first time, period of time, that 7 months I didn't drink, I did it for my father. Not consciously, but I just did it for him. And the second time, I did it for the people in the halfway house because I was tired of hurting people. But this time, I wanted to do it for me. And it wasn't an arrogant attitude of, well, I'll show them I can do it. I'll prove to them I can stay sober. It wasn't that at all. I was just done. Just that, a quiet surrender on the inside. Just a willingness for the first time to go to any lengths. Because I now saw and felt what you had, and I did want a part of that. I told the people in the halfway house what had happened. Of course, I had to, and they gave me an interesting option because they said, well, you can either leave or we can put you back into a hospital within 24 hours. And I said, I don't need a hospital. I don't need more therapy. I need action. And I don't know where that came from. I guess I'd been to one too many meetings to hear something like that. But I knew I needed action. And that still is the key to me. I've learned from my teachers that I can think whatever I want to think. It's what I do that will change me and my thinking. And so I knew it was action, and I knew I had to get out there, and I had to start going to meetings and doing the things and showing up and getting into Alcoholics Anonymous. And the people I went to are the old-timers. And to me, I was 18 at that time. The old-timers were anybody who'd been sober longer than I'd been alive. And at 30, there's still a whole bunch of them out there. But I went to them and I said, you know, what do I do to stay sober? And I followed them around and I tried to practice their example, and I got involved and I was active in Alcoholics Anonymous and service, and I loved it. I just was so filled with AA activity in my life. And I, about 4 years sober, I moved to Atlanta. And Atlanta was very good to me while I was there. And when I arrived, I decided, well, I've been pretty active in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, service-wise and all that for 4 years. I think I'll just kind of take a little break and then I'll get involved with things, but I just don't want to come on down here and tell them how to do everything, and I'll just observe. And so my few months ended up being a couple of years. I was active in meetings, and I was going to meetings and taking new people and on the 12-step list and going on calls and that sort of thing, but I wasn't really doing a whole lot of giving to the meeting. And I'd have a little job there every year, but it just wasn't the AA activity I'd been used to. And so I, that couple of years, I was complacency. It was just so gradual. It just moved on in. And I thought, well, it's good for me to kind of be able to sit around with myself for a little while and to just kind of be quiet and learn how to do that. But God, I can take that right into isolation, you know, and that isn't good, you know. After a couple of years, I'd been sober 6 years, and about 3 weeks after my sixth birthday, it was on a Friday night, I met a little fella. Well, that's no big deal, but what was about to happen would be a big deal to me. What I'm about to share with you, I have seen happen to people with men or women or jobs or power or success or whatever. I have seen this kind of obsession with lots of different people in lots of different ways. Mine happened to be with fellows. That's how it ended up coming out. I met a little fellow on a Friday night, and I thought, this is a neat deal. He's single. Isn't that great? He's of eligible age. He's got quite a bit of money. And he is sober 13 years. Now, just because he hasn't been to that many meetings in the last 3 years, that doesn't make any difference. That's okay. I go to meetings, and come on, he can come along with me. And so for the next 3 months, I was really pretty involved with this relationship. There was one slight problem, however. He didn't know anything about it. And, you know, it really is advantageous when there's somebody in there with you. It's a lot more fun that way. And what happened to me, I can easily describe to you the personality that seemed to just emerge back overnight, but really wasn't overnight, was that same personality. If you'd have replaced him with a bottle of whiskey and a hit or two of acid, you'd have found that same desperate, obsessive personality. Because my whole life had revolved around drinking, and now it revolved around this guy. My whole life had been just a great day or a not-so-great day, whether or not I'd been able to drink. And now it revolved around whether or not he called, where I went, what I wore. My mind was totally obsessed with this bottle, and now it was obsessed with another human being. And I just, I had more roadblocks thrown up. This was a period of time that I demanded to God things, and I didn't understand why they weren't happening. I was telling him I'm letting it go, and yet I clung harder than ever before. I had a pity pot on, barricaded on me that three grenades couldn't have blown off. It was so tightly strapped on there. I'd walk into a meeting with an attitude of, by God, you better say something magical tonight to me, you know. And I didn't like that. And yet it's like I couldn't seem to get past that point. And I would say, but I'm doing. And I guess I just wasn't doing. I wasn't doing anything for free or for fun. And I wasn't being of service just to be of service. And finally, the thing I am most grateful for is that I never quit going to meetings. So I knew the minute I made the first excuse not to go to a meeting, the second would come twice as fast. I've always known that, and I've never stopped going to meetings regardless of what seems to be a problem or the great times in my life when I feel so great I don't think I need a meeting, you know. Those are just as dangerous to me too. But I never quit going to meetings. Finally got through a roadblock, and he'd been throwing them in all along, but I finally had one that I had to kind of recognize, and that was the guy got married to somebody else. So I let him go. I just found another guy like that and married him off to somebody else 3 months later, too. About this time, I decided that probably I better get out of the matchmaking business for myself. It wasn't really successful, and I'm tired of doing this. That little definition of insanity we have of doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, really came into play for me at this point. And I knew I had to do something different, and the pain was getting greater and greater all the time. And finally, I guess I just reached a point of surrender. And I went to a convention that weekend because I needed and wanted to be around a bunch of AA people, and I needed to hear the message. And I went, and I'm tired of living this way. Okay, you're tired of living that way, you want to live somewhere else? You got to change. And to change for me meant to face reality. And the person who I really was somebody I didn't want to face. I'm 6.5 years sober, and I realize what an abuser and abuser of people I am. I'm more a user and abuser of people at 6.5 years sober than I ever was drunk. And I'm not very proud of that, and I don't know what to do about it, because I know that is my innermost self. And so finally the time had come for me to face that. And I went to this convention, and on a Friday night, I heard the first message for the weekend. I heard that people, places, and things don't make me happy. I've heard that a jillion times. And yet that night was the first time I really heard it. This guy was talking about when he was drunk, and I'm talking about 6.5 years sober. I'm looking at people and places and things to make me happy. I adjusted the words a little bit to be more appropriate to me. I just put men, money, and mansions don't make me happy. Now, not that one or all of the above are good, bad, indifferent, right, or wrong. I'm not here to make any claims on that. What I wanted to do with them, however, was abuse them. And to, you know, be frankly honest, I wanted to just be humbly mega wealthy. That's all. I mean, you know, that's all I wanted to do. Let's take care of all the outside stuff, and then I'll work on the spiritual. But you see, I've read, I've been taught, and I've had it experienced in my life and many others that I've seen. The spiritual must always come before the material, because when it does, for me, then the material is not so important. Because apparently I've been placing any worth that I have on that material. And that's not where it's going to be for longer than 5 minutes after you bring it home. And so that was the message for Friday night. Well, okay, so Saturday night I hear, if you've got some family business that you've got yet to take care of, don't wait till they've died and say you wish you would have. Take care of it now. And what happened to me is I heard that last clanking skeleton in the back of my closet. I had never made amends to my stepmother. It was a bad deal for a long time. And I was a budding alcoholic on their hands. And maybe she and I were too much alike, but the day after they were married, the World War III in our home began. And I'd never made amends to her. That resentment and anger had dissipated over the years, but when he said that, I knew now was the time. Now, I don't ever profess to be very clever or anything like that, but I knew that now was the time in that I'd never put her on my amends list because I didn't want to make amends to her, and I knew they would haunt me until I did. And so I just left her off the list. So now, at almost 7 years, it's time to make amends. And I made amends to my stepmother that year. I'd gone back and I'd really studied and reviewed with my sponsor those steps, and I made my eighth and ninth steps, and I felt so great. God, I felt great about that. Well, I lived on that good feeling for my whole seventh year, and then I tried to extend it into my eighth year, and I'm wondering why I'm feeling kind of funny again and kind of not really with it. And I'm still working with new people, but that spark and that aliveness isn't there like it had been before. And that's why I like Alcoholics Anonymous, because we say the same stuff over and over, but I might have missed it last night. But I might hear it tonight. And I heard it that night. If I got anything out of that guy's talk, I heard that him talking about those same kinds of feelings. And he said he was realized he was living today on last year's program. And that came into focus that's right. My past glories and what I did that I should have been doing all along was for then. That was then and this is now. What I have to do today is the maintenance of today. And it put that day at a time back in new perspective to me that it really is today that I have to make count to get me to hopefully tomorrow morning. And then yesterday, my past glories or accomplishments or anything are past. They're history. I moved along and a few years later, about a year and a half ago, I got married. And a lot of you know Johnny, and it was nice because we'd been friends ever since I'd been sober, and acquaintances and became friends, and then now we're married. So it's been a neat deal. It's my first marriage. I was 29, and I don't say first marriage like I'm going to get married a whole bunch of times, you know, but I know there's a lot of repeat offenders here, you know. And so I got married for my first time, and it's really a neat deal, and I'm so glad that I had, you know, at that time, I guess, 10 or 11 years of sobriety, because it's been an interesting deal. I came out here. I love it out here. It's been very exciting and new, and I just love the enthusiasm I see here. It has been such a, I don't know what happened. When I turned 10, I felt inside such a greater commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just, I love it. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It is more important to me, and that desperation is more with me today, and the need for meetings is more with me today than it ever was before. And Johnny and I have a great life today. We're both active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just love my life today. Everything in my life is a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for allowing me the privilege to close another day of mine in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I thank you.